From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On today's episode, we look back on the epic Western miniseries Lonesome Dove with the show's producers, cast, and crew, including Robert Duvall, Danny Glover, Diane Lane, Suzanne DePass, and many more.
Well, I've gotten to travel a lot. Wherever you go, people know about Lonesome Dove.
Everybody in the film belonged there.
I was invited to come and audition for Buffalo Heifer.
And I said, you know, we can do without the cattle totally. We just do it with goats. We'll have them buy a small herd of goats, and they'll be the first guy to take a herd of goats to Montana.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. The 1989 Western miniseries Lonesome Dove is adapted from the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel written by Larry McMurtry. During its original run, an estimated 26 million homes tuned in to watch Robert Duvall, Tommy Lee Jones, and an all-star cast start out in a South Texas border town and make their way north on a cattle drive to Montana. On Story was part of a very special event this past March, and we've edited the discussions we recorded at the Lonesome Dove Reunion and Trail in Fort Worth, Texas, to bring you this episode. We'd like to extend very special thanks to Bill and Sally Whitliff, the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University and Texas State University itself, Texas Christian University, and Performing Arts Fort Worth Incorporated for all of their efforts. We begin this episode with series producer Suzanne DePass recounting the circumstances that led her to acquire the rights to produce this beloved series.
You know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, but you do know what you love. I met Larry McMurtry in Tucson. I was there with my ex-husband, and we were at a spa where they served like one lettuce leaf and a pimento strip or something. And I ran into Gloria Steinem in the women's locker room. And she said, "We're going off campus tonight for Mexican food." And before she got it out of her mouth, I said, "Yes." Like real food. And they said they were joining friends, and those friends happened to be Larry McMurtry and Leslie Silko, a friend of his. And I really enjoyed meeting Larry, and he and I hit it off, and we were yakking it up and, you know, gabbing and all that. And I said to him, "Next time you're in L.A., I'd love to take you to lunch." And he said, "Okay." And I thought, well, I'd never see him again. And sure enough, he called, and we went to lunch, and I had just been installed as the head of Motown Productions, which was the film and TV arm of Motown Industries, as it was called. Anyway, long story short, I said, "What do you have kicking around the old trunk that hasn't been produced yet?" And he said, "Well, I have a book coming out in June." This was like March. He said, "But you wouldn't like it. It's a Western." And I said, "But you're wrong. I love Westerns," which I did. And I was a horsewoman, that he didn't know that, and had grown up in the East, showing horses and riding and teaching and stuff like that. And had moved to L.A., where I traded my English saddle for a Western saddle. And so he said, "Well, call my agent," which I did, the famous Swifty Lazar. And the next day, a flatbed dolly rolled into my office, because it was unbound galleys at the time, and it was in ream boxes of paper, double-spaced. And it looked like a forest had thrown up on this truck. And just, it was unbelievable. And so I started taking home a box every night. And sure enough, midway through, I said, "This is one of the greatest things I've ever read." I called Lazar even before I'd finished reading the book. And I said, "I really would like to have this." And he said, "Great." And he said, "The option is $50,000. I said, "Great." Who knew? Because I was used to making records for $100,000, so it sounded all right to me. Well, turns out that, you know, every studio and every network had passed on it, as I was informed by a woman who was working with me, who had come from Warner Brothers. And she said, I don't know how to tell you this, but Swifty just took you. And that's why they call him Swifty. But I think he felt guilty, so he gave me 18 months instead of the requisite, the usual 12-month option. So I spent $50,000 of Berry Gordy's money for the option of Lonesome Dove. And about 15 minutes after Swifty Lazar cashed the check, one of my colleagues who had worked at Warner Brothers came in and delivered the news that it had been passed on everywhere. And she handed me a document of which this is the last page. And it's from the Warner Brothers coverage department, coverage meaning evaluation department. October 1st, 1984. This is a long, drawn-out tale that ultimately boils down to nothing. At story's end, on page 1557, she was reading the manuscript, nothing has been resolved. Gus and Dietz and Jake are maybe dead, but Call still hasn't acknowledged Newt. Lorena hasn't noticed Dish, nor made it plain she isn't going to. Nor has Clara given July an answer on his proposal. We don't even know if Call will go back to Montana or stay in Lonesome Dove. Most especially, we don't even know why this is called Lonesome Dove. Even why it's called Lonesome Dove, since they leave early on in the book and only Call returns at the end. What is especially unsatisfying about this book is that the only hero, in quotes, we are left with at the end is Woodrow Call, a cold, hard-hearted man who is more concerned about his duty than about caring for people. The role of Newt could be a good one, but all in all, this novel just doesn't seem worth developing. It will cost a fortune to produce, and except for a couple of interesting characters, Gus and Dietz, has only the standard action going for it. It appears contrived when everyone keeps winding up in the same places. July and his group in the wilderness with Blue Duck. Lorena and Gus. Later, they all show up at Clara's horse ranch. Surely, the Wild West was big enough, a big enough place that people didn't keep bumping into one another like that. The downbeat ending looks to kill any box office potential, especially as it appears McMurtry only stopped writing because he got tired of his characters and story. Not because he finished his story. Unsatisfactory all the way around. Lonesome Dove, underlined, pass. And so, feeling like the goat, I said, okay. And Larry and I set about a strategy of meeting with directors. And we met with Peter Bogdanovich, who took complete credit for the original screenplay, which had been written to reunite John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda. We met with John Milius. We met with John Huston. And I learned, as each of them was sort of saying how they would approach Lonesome Dove, that this could not be done as a movie, period. You know, they would talk about getting rid of fat, then muscle, than bone, and so the structure just fell down on itself. And, you know, because I didn't know what I didn't know, I said, well, let's do a miniseries. Who knew that they were dead? I was coming from the record business. So we were represented at the time by ICM, an agency. Larry wrote an outline for a miniseries, and one day we were having a drink, and he said, well, you know, Suzanne, I'm all written out on Lonesome Dove. Bye. I'm on to my next thing. So there I am with now a bestseller, a town that was completely shut down to Westerns and to miniseries and to this particular project, and feeling pretty terrible. One day, Swifty called me back in early spring, and he said, kid, I want you to know today Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove has won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. And so I went from goat to goddess. Very quickly. And the world changed.
Wow. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're spotlighting the iconic Western miniseries Lonesome Dove on this episode of On Story. The content for the show was recorded over 2 days in March of 2016 at the Lonesome Dove Reunion and Trail in Fort Worth, Texas. Up next, Barbara Morgan speaks with the show's producer, Suzanne DePass, screenwriter Bill Whitliff, series director Simon Windsor, and producer Dyson Lovell on the development of Lonesome Dove.
How did you start the process of putting this team of people together to take this book into a format of development to make it happen?
The first thing is that we were represented by ICM, and ICM suggested that one of their clients, a man called Bill Whitliff, would be perfect, and so you should just put him on the project. And I said, without meeting him? Are you kidding? How can you do that? So I went out to the valley, to the...
Safari.
Thank you. Motel. Bill was in town. And we met, and from that moment, I knew I not only met a great human being, but also a partner. He was warm and accepting. I mean, forget that he's wildly talented, but from that day to this day, if I am the mother of Lonesome Dove, surely he is the father.
So, Bill, that's a pretty big order to take that story, as packed as it was. And how did you go about that process of deciding what stayed, what went?
Suzanne did a great thing for me. She had somebody read the whole book on tape. And Sally and I have a place down at South Padre, which from Austin, where we lived, is a 6-hour drive. And I would plug in a tape, and that 6 hours essentially equaled an episode. When you're listening to it and you're driving and you don't have a pencil in your hand, then you start seeing it. Anyway, and then 6 hours later, I'm at South Padre, and I write for a week and have a rough outline, if nothing else, of that particular episode. And then I get in the pickup and start driving back to Austin and do the next 6 hours. But the other deal is, you know, like Larry's story is just so great. There was not a problem writing the script, and it didn't really feel so daunting either, because it was so human. You knew all those people. You knew the things they were talking about and they're crying about, laughing about. And I think that's one reason Lonesome Dove resonates. You know, it is us. It's certainly who we want to believe we are or where we came from.
Simon, you're from Australia. And yep. Dyson, Zimbabwe. Why don't you talk to us about how you came with this crew of folks? Because it seems like kismet, but clearly you made choices here for reasons. So,
I lived in Australia, but I'd done a couple of successful miniseries for CBS. And so I was actually flown to the United States to meet with Suzanne and Dyson and some other executives from Motown. And after I passed that test, it was suggested that Dyson and I fly to Austin, Texas, to meet Bill Whitliff, who had the casting vote. So we duly went the next day to meet Bill, and you immediately warm to Bill because he's always got a twinkle in his eye, and it's still there even today. And Bill said to Dyson, look, I'd just like to take Simon out to dinner on his own just so we can get to know each other a bit and talk about the book. And so duly, Bill and I went out to his country club. We sat down and ordered our appetizers, and I always in America enjoy the way they do prawn cocktail, so I ordered a prawn cocktail, and Bill ordered oysters on the shell. And they were duly served, and Bill cracked open the first oyster, and sitting right in the middle was a giant pearl. And Bill looked up at me and said, I think this is a sign.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're spotlighting the iconic Western miniseries Lonesome Dove on this episode of On Story. The content for this show was recorded over 2 days in March of 2016 at the Lonesome Dove Reunion and Trail in Fort Worth, Texas. We pick up with producer Dyson Lovell and screenwriter and executive producer Bill Whitliff discussing their arrival to the project.
I did a very successful film with Lee Grant for CBS, and they sent for me, and they said, we'd like to do something else with you. Have you ever thought about a Western? And I said, well, I was born in Zimbabwe. I used to ride horses, but I don't know anything about a Western. And they said, well, we're very interested in you doing this. And Suzanne de Pass is the executive producer of it. Do you know her? I said, well, yes, I do know Suzanne. She just put the music together for Endless Love with Lionel Richie doing the music and Franco Zeffirelli directed. I remember Frankovich said, well, we're going to call her and tell her we'd like you to do it, and I want you to call her and tell her you'd like to do it. So that was a double-pronged thing, and so I became honored enough to be asked to produce it.
Suzanne optioned Larry's book. Then she went over to CBS and she said, let's make this as a miniseries. And they said, Suzanne, you know, Westerns are dead and so are miniseries and so on. But she prevailed and they gave her enough money to hire a screenwriter. And if they liked the screenplay, then they would consider making it as a movie. Good for Suzanne, good for CBS, and really good for me, because then Suzanne called me and asked if I would write the script, and I did. And then about a year later, Suzanne and I sent it to CBS and didn't hear anything for about a week or 10 days. And then Suzanne called me one day and she said, we've got trouble. And I said, what kind of trouble? And she said, CBS says it costs too much to make. So Suzanne and I went over to CBS. There was a room full of executives. We said, well, what's the problem? And they said, it costs too much money to make. And then another guy said, it's those damn cows. They cost too much money. And we explained that this was a story about a handful of cowboys from South Texas that took the first herd of cattle to Montana. We have to have the cattle. But one of the executives said, not necessarily. He said, you know that scene where they all jump and run off? And I said, are you talking about the stampede scene? He said, yeah, you know, there's lightning or thunder or somebody throws a rock or whatever it is. But he said, and then all the cattle run off. And we said, yeah. And he said, hell, just let them go. And he said, Bill, you're writing the dialogue. Just have Gus turn to call and say, well, there went our cows. And then have Call say, yeah, but we're already on the way, so let's just keep going, you know. And one of them slapped his knees, and he said, yeah, yeah. And I said, you know, we can do without the cattle totally. We just do it with goats. We'll have them buy a small herd of goats, and they'll be the first guy to take a herd of goats to Montana. And that's when the guy slapped his knees, and he said, yeah, goats, perfect, that's great. And then we had to explain we were just joking. But what we did was buy a small herd of goats. Jimmy Medeiros bought us a small herd of cattle, excuse me. And those were the cattle in the movie. And at the end of the shoot, the market had gone up enough that we actually made a little money on the cattle.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're celebrating the epic Western miniseries Lonesome Dove on this episode of the show. In our next segment, producer Suzanne de Pass speaks with several members of the illustrious ensemble cast, including Robert Duvall, Danny Glover, Rick Schroeder, and first, Chris Cooper, who played Arkansas Sheriff July Johnson.
I'd read a lot of Larry McMurtry and heard it was coming that they were auditioning people. And I believe y'all first went to California and read a lot of actors for the role of July. And then I was living in New York. I had only done one feature, a film directed and written by John Sayles called Mate One. I'd done one or two TV movies and some of these episodics like that Florida crime drama where the guys were riding Miami Vice.
Crockett and Tubbs.
And a lot of New York actors got, that was a big kick for their career. Then I heard they were coming to read just a few people in New York, and I have no idea how I qualified because my life was theater. I had done 12 years of theater and then this one feature in these little movies of the week, and thank goodness my wife kind of pushed me.
I just want to say that you shouldn't be confused about how you got the role because you were great.
Dyson Lovell found me when I was 7 years old in New York. They were auditioning for the movie The Champ. And so that's how I got to know Dyson. And that's when my career began, when I was seven. I did, you know, various movies, got to work with great actors. And then, you know, as the temptations of money become into people's consciousness, I got put into this TV show, Silver Spoons, when I was 12. And so I did that for 5 years, and I was 17 when that ended. I'd just spent 5 years on a soundstage, you know, between 12 and 17, working 12 hours a day, and it was a different life. You know, I didn't get to go outside a lot. I was in dark buildings like this. I didn't really want to go back to work. And then Lonesome Dove came around, and they said, you really should read this Western. And I said, I did a movie with horses once. I didn't like it. And I said, no, I'm not interested. And I was really allergic to horses, so I said, no. Then I got a phone call back, and they said, no, you have to reconsider. And Dyson said, we'll wash the horse. We'll wash the horse every day. So they talked me into it.
I want to tell a bit of an anecdote about how Bobby came to it, because we were absolutely convinced, and we sent you Lonesome Dove for the role of Captain Call. I don't know if you remember that.
Well, let me say this. My ex-wife, or my ex-wife-to-be, it was kind of that limbo state. She said, I've read a book that is so great, I can't get over it. She said, you have to read this book. And her words were, I like it better than Dostoevsky. Said, but let me tell you something. They're going to come for you for the part of Call, but you can't do that part. You have to do the part of Augustus McCrae. And it, because of my ex-wife-to-be, I will thank her for the rest of my life. Because, you know, whenever I hear the word Lonesome Dove, there's something just sits in me. I can't explain what it is. It just sits there. When we finished the movie, I felt I'd done something pretty good, that I could retire. But I haven't retired, and I'm probably the oldest guy in the house here tonight. But I did come into the dining hall one day, and I said, boys, we're making the Godfather of Westerns.
When you get a call from Suzanne DePass, you pay attention to it because of all the great work that she's done. And then when you see the cast, you got Bobby Duvall, Tommy Lee Jones in the cast. You got some Angelica Houston, Diane Lane. You got so many people, great people in the cast. But I tell you, it's everybody in the film belong there. You believe that they belong there. You believe that these men and women who inhabit this space. And that's another part of it, too, that was wonderful. You don't often get an opportunity to do this kind of work. And I think the passion that's in the writing, not only the book itself, but the translation of the book by Bill, is one of the great moments. It remains one of those moments, you know, where you put, yes, I'm glad I was there.
That's lovely.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm Brian Ramos. We continue our exploration of the legendary miniseries Lonesome Dove on this episode of the show. Here, Barbara Morgan speaks with Diane Lane and Margot Martindale on their involvement in the cast of Lonesome Dove.
Lori Darling. So you started your career with Laurence Olivier and then went on to work with people like Richard Gere. By the time you're 23, you're being offered to work on this project. How did this come about for you? What was your decision process to go into, again, a miniseries and a Western?
Well, first of all, I feel very grateful to be a part of Lonesome Dove, period. And certainly it's become the fabric of my life, and I'm kind of amazed that I'm in it. I still kind of feel like, wow, I got that part. it is iconic. The book is a Pulitzer winner for a reason. And living up to these characters was something that was really, there was so much love and passion that everybody who read the book had for these characters. So I found out yesterday in the car ride to another Lonesome Dove event from Dyson Lovell, our wonderful producer. He told me that I didn't have much TV cred. TV is different than movies, and I didn't have a lot of TV cachet, and I didn't help. It wasn't a perk to get me. It was sort of like they were doing me a favor to bring me to a new audience. So I still feel lucky in that regard. But the truth is that there's many parts of Lorena Wood, and I have my stories of creating her, and I have my memories that I treasure, and I could talk for hours about them because they were fun and they're precious, and it's nice that we get to celebrate our happy memories. That's rare. And also the tragedy of her truth that people conveniently forget because it's too painful and sad and scary and horrible. Honestly, I mean, her life was tragic, and she didn't speak much. In the book, she hardly speaks. She's so shut down emotionally. And the preciousness of the relationship that she has with Gus, in the sense that he has access to her trust when she's only available and only useful for one thing in that town, and that her life is so barren, and yet she has a spark in her heart and a flower and a sweetness about her. And there was a lot of contradictions that coexisted, and she's a complex character. I love her. She's precious to me.
Did you seek Diane out when you were deciding on casting that role, or did your agents bring it to you?
It's hard to remember exactly how, now that I know Simon has a list of people that we auditioned, that some of the biggest names in the world that we did not give the parts to, but who become the biggest names in the world. But, you know, it's almost like trying to unring a bell when it did happen. The memory of how it happened evaporates because you're into that reality of it's Diane Lane, you know, and that's Lorena Wood, and forever it shall be so. And I don't know who those other women were, you know, I don't care.
Yay. See, I still feel lucky. It's true.
So, Margot, I'm not going to call you by your name. Which I'm sure you didn't even know what that was when you got cast.
I did.
Did you? This was either your first film role or one of your first film roles. Can you talk about a little bit of your background after you left Jacksonville, Texas, for New York?
I went north. And I went to University of Michigan, then I found myself in New York City, and I was a theater actress, and I struggled and did play after play after play. And then finally this little play came along that I thought, eh, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't, and it was called Steel Magnolias. And and it was that time when I was invited by Lynn Kressel, because I had a little visibility, to come and audition for Buffalo Heifer. And I was pregnant, and I didn't tell anybody. And then I finally said to my agent, I think you should call them and tell them I'm pregnant, so they're not going to want me to do this. So I got word back and said, even better. So, yeah. I'm so thrilled, being a Texan, to be part... It made me cry. It's so cool.
So, Diane, how much... I mean, you and Duvall had such incredible chemistry. And had you ever worked together before? And then how much time did you actually have to prepare together? Did you do a lot of rehearsing to be able to have that chemistry on screen, or was it just natural?
So funny that you say that, and thank you, because it was nice to feel part of the chemistry that was he created, because honestly, he cast a spell as Gus. He was basically in character the whole time, which I didn't realize until we went to promote the film when it was coming out. I call it a film. We filmed it. It's a film. But anyway, and I felt like I met Bobby for the first time. I'm like, who are you, and what have you done with Gus? Where is he? I know he's here somewhere. I don't know what that is. And he's an actor who works that way, and I love that about him. Everybody has their process. And I know he had great love for Gus. That was, I've heard him say that it was his favorite character ever played. And I can understand that. And it certainly comes through the film that way, through the screen. I feel such love for this man. And he's got such a joy of living. And he does have great words of wisdom. And I think every man needs a Lorena to feel smart and be benefiting a woman in that way, the kind of largesse d'esprit that he has. Some of the sage words that he gets to say to her and encourage her. I think that's the definition of love, is to give encouragement. Even after he was no longer around physically, his spirit lived on through the gifts that he'd given spiritually to those whose lives he touched. So it's a legendary character. And she loved him. And I loved Bobby. I guess that was Gus. I don't know where Bobby ends and Gus begins, to tell you the truth. And we like it that way. He comes up and he says, "Lori, darling." And I'm like, "You got it." I mean, only for you, you know. But it's true. It's a lingering kind of affection that came from the love of these characters when we read the book. So,
but while you were working on that, I mean, were these hard places to get to emotionally? I mean, how did you prepare for that?
Yes, is a complete sentence. The stakes are very high. The emotional stakes. You know, and we didn't have a lot of time. What do we have, 11 pages a day?
Yeah, some days were 11 pages.
Yeah, so get it right and get on down the road. I mean, it sounds harsh, but the truth is that we didn't have the luxury of being able to sneak up on this stuff. That was today, and then you have something else to film that day, and you go, really? Can't I just go home now? Isn't that enough? But no, we got to do the other scene. So that's life in showbiz, but the truth of the matter is that it's a very sacred experience. We have the flicker of these images, and we tell the stories, and we feel each other's pain, and we get healed from it. And that is, you have to feel the pain to heal it. So that's my offering. I didn't realize it at the time. I wasn't very circumspect. I was panicked about getting it right. But now I can experience it and see it for what it is and be so grateful I got to do it.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We've been spotlighting the iconic Western miniseries Lonesome Dove on this episode of On Story. The content for this show was recorded over 2 days in March of 2016 at the Lonesome Dove Reunion and Trail in Fort Worth, Texas. We continue with the show's director, Simon Windsor, and screenwriter Bill Whitman, describing some of the challenges of working with herds of livestock for the show, which depicts a cattle drive from South Texas to Montana.
The one thing probably people don't understand is to get a mob of galloping horses, it takes a quarter of a mile to get them up to speed and under control, and that's after a lot of work with the wranglers in rehearsal. It takes a half a mile to get those tracking shots where you've got vehicles tracking along beside them, and then another quarter of a mile to pull them up. So that gives you a square mile, which has to be lit. Not long before Lonesome Dove came into being, a thing called the Musco Light came into being, which is a giant sort of light that goes 100 feet in the air with its own generating power, and that has enough power to literally light up a square mile. And what's great about it, you could light one location, literally turn the light around and face another direction, and you've got a whole lot of other locations you can use because it's just a bit too big and heavy and the landscape too difficult to sort of move. So you're able to achieve with quite simple lighting the difficulty of shooting these scenes at night. And there's also a great danger factor because visibility is not as good for... But, you know, that's the real cast in galloping in amongst the horses. I see a great shot of Danny Glover, who's with us today down there. And the wonderful thing was, and I think those of you who saw the Cowboys talk earlier today, they were all able to do their own riding, which we probably wouldn't be able to pull that off today because there's so many rules and regulations now with insurance. And every film is made up of little bits and they're all joined together, and there's a lot of magic created in editing. But cattle don't like being stampeded. They don't want to run, you know. They like to just amble along, and to get them to do take after take just so the dust is the right thickness, because sometimes they'd be throw too much in front of the fans and you don't see anything, or if you don't throw enough, that it looks like a sunny day and you've got wind machines and stuff like that. So the most trying part of the whole thing was really just stampeding the cattle. But again, bless the cast, they all hang in there and they're all there. You can see them, you know. And that was the very early days of CGI, and of course, most other weather conditions we fortuitously got during the shoot, but the storm was one thing we never got, so it had to be artificially created. The lightning occurring and then electrocuting their sort of horns, that was inspired by Remington's famous picture, The Stampede, which is on display at the Sid Richardson Museum at the moment, and those that haven't seen it should go and see it because it's breathtaking.
There are cowboy diaries that talk about storms and lightning, and the lightning will bounce from horn to horn. Yeah. And I think that actually, that was done by a computer, but I think that's the first time it was ever done by a computer.
You're absolutely right, it was. I remember the first time I saw it, my eyes were wide open. Wow, this is obviously the future. The other interesting thing is this was one of the very first shows ever edited non-linear. In other words, we didn't edit on film. We used the first sort of computerized editing system, which was called CMX 6000, and the film was transferred onto a laser disc, and we edited on that, and it's come a long way since then, but that was really the first time it had ever been done, certainly on a miniseries.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm Brian Ramos. We continue with our discussion of the iconic Western Lonesome Dove. In our next segment, screenwriter Bill Whitliff, director Simon Windsor, producer Suzanne DePass, the show's co-star Robert Duvall, and costume designer Van Ramsey discuss the look of the characters in Lonesome Dove. Here's Bill Whitliff.
One of the first guys we hired was Van Ramsey to do the costumes. He was a genius at what he does and one of the dearest men on earth. He's just a terrific guy. But Van, even though he was from Wharton, Texas, didn't know a lot about Westerns. So we brought him over to my office where I have a lot of books on the West and photographic books and so on. And basically sat him down for a week, and he sat at my desk, and he looked at these books. And we told him, you know, if you don't see it in one of these books, which are the authentic look, then we don't want to see it on the screen. His genius is to make a character out of the clothes. And if you look at the hats, Call's is, you know, absolutely straight. It's a round top just out of the box. I mean, there's no personality to it. There's no shape to it. You know, it's just hard edge. It's all business. Whereas Gus has got a little twinkle. You want to see him tip that hat.
There wasn't a single hat that Bill didn't supervise. I remember that. We used to say, have you seen Hattie yet? And that was...
The other important thing in a Western is a lot of scenes take place on horseback, of course, and depend a lot on silhouettes, and you want to recognize who the characters are if there's seven or eight horses. And there's a classic example in Lonesome Dove where they ride off from the Hat Creek outfit to go into Mexico the first night to steal horses. And as they ride silhouette across the bridge in Lonesome Dove, you can recognize each character just by the shape of the hat in the silhouette, and that's incredibly important.
One of the things about Gus's character is your wardrobe in Lonesome Dove is so distinctive, the boots, the hat. Looking at this now, what do you remember about coming to that look for Gus? Because
Van Ramsey, he's a brilliant, brilliant. Yeah. He had a California bootmaker make me a wonderful pair of boots out of one piece of leather, and I had it. And you know, we pieced things together, and he just he was great to work with. You know, it was. When you put something on, it just feels right, and you don't have to go any further. The main thing in a Western, I think, and Buster Welch, I think, would agree with that, is the hat and then the horse. You have to find a good horse, you know. You know, I hadn't ridden in a while, but there's a man named Rodney Jenkins, and he's one of the great horsemen in American history. He's like the Eastern jumping horse rider counterpart of Buster Welch, and I went to him. I worked with him, then he put me with different people, and I rode horses 2-3 hours a day, jumped horses, all kinds of stuff, till I knew that with the clothes and with everything that I could. I didn't want the stuntman doing my riding, because my riding was my riding. Then I felt I could ride anything that was needed for the movie. That was very important, I think, the hat and the horse.
You read the script and then you break down how many changes or how many days are in the script and how many changes you think each character should have. And it appears a lot in Lonesome Dove that they're only wearing the same thing all the time. But there are multiples of those clothes that are made, and they're aged at different levels of wear because you don't shoot in sequence. That's when it becomes difficult. It's creating that world. In the beginning, we chose to do Call black and white, and so that left kind of earth tones and colors for Gus, trying to keep him likable, and the color helped a lot as far as that goes, as opposed to black. He was very simple. I mean, we kept him really simple. But the difference between this project and other television projects that I've done, this was a total collaboration where Eric and I worked together, and Bill was there every day. I mean, every day, and making sure that it was right and that things were aged right and that kind of thing. And, you know, when you get up at 3 a.m. to dress 400 people, and then you get home at 11:30 that night, and it goes on and on and on. And every time we thought we had caught up, there would be some phone call. Oh, we're going to do something, and you just want to kill yourself. Yeah. And you know, people kept saying, yeah. Oh, Lonesome Dove, it must be so much fun. I never had fun.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm Brian Ramos. Continuing the discussion of Lonesome Dove, cast member Barry Tubb speaks with the show's production designer Carrie White and property master Eric Williams, and producer Suzanne DePass and costume designer Van Ramsey reflect on the creation of the show.
On this show, you had a Western where you've got 13, I believe it was 13 cowboys, 13 horses, 13 saddles, and we're literally hauling
loads. That's guns, explain it, guns,
yeah,
saddles.
Yeah, guns, saddles, pistols, their rifles, and everything that goes on the horse, not just the man. So you've got bridles and you know, the wranglers help with that, but it's your job to try to pick those things out.
Yeah, that's a lot of this movie, the word kismet kind of comes into play, because a lot of things over the shoot of this movie just fell into place like that. And earlier this morning, I told a story about when it started snowing. Somebody mentioned that a minute ago. Do you want to tell that story, one of y'all?
Well, we were up in Angel Fire, and it was June, and it started snowing. And that there's a shot in there, which is a pretty amazing shot, because this technology has been gone from Hollywood for a long time. But it was an actual glass shot where we had a guy, an artist, come paint the snow on a piece of glass in front of the camera. Well, he goes, when it starts snowing, he goes, oh, I guess I'm out of a job. And we actually ended up using his shot, too. But it was, you know, just amazing that it started snowing in the middle of June. And it was like...
Yeah, every movie has a call sheet, which just tells you what you're going to do the next day. And the call sheet for that day said, make snow, special effects, make snow. And it snowed. And it was June. Early June.
Happy accidents, we call it in the movie business. But yeah, this movie was, you know, I was just a kid and I was amazed, you know, just watching all this happen. But
I remember when Tommy Lee arrived, because at the time, Tommy Lee was not the age of Carl McRae. And they performed miracles in this little trailer. And so Tommy Lee went in there with dark hair, dark beard, and came out completely white-haired, white beard. But what it took to get that little trailer was rocking on its wheels, because they had to strip his hair, and then they had to strip it again. And I think it was probably torture for him. I'm sorry he's not here to validate that. But the transformation that was made, and of course in those days we didn't have smartphones to capture every moment of our lives. So, but you know, you just see him go in looking completely different and coming out as Carl.
The one night that Bill went home, and it must have been like 2 o'clock in the morning, I walked into the makeup trailer. Tommy Lee Jones is telling Blue Duck that he should wear a woman's dress, like he had killed her and put on her dress. And of course, Fred Forrest buys into this big time and goes, yeah, that would be really great, like I killed her and put on her dress. And you know, this is going back and forth, and suddenly it's serious. He wants a woman. He told me to go get him a woman's dress off the extras trailer that would fit him. And that's when I had to call Mr. Whitlip and say, you have to put a stop to this right now.
You know, I shouldn't tell this, but Frederick Forrest, we were shooting in outside of Santa Fe. It was supposed to be Ogallala. And there was this huge fight going on, this huge loud argument with the producer and directors and Frederick Forrest. But the assistant director tickled me. He sticks his head out and says to our crew, could you hold the work while we're fighting in here?
I have a thing to add to that. Tommy, when that little altercation started, Tommy turned on his heels and walked out, and every single one of the sheriffs that were extras, without being told, turned on their heels and followed him right out the door. And when he got outside, I was outside, and Carrie was outside, and TL says, worst behavior I've ever seen. And I looked at TL and I said, really? On this show? And he said, second worst behavior I've ever seen.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. The music of Lonesome Dove is as iconic as the images. In this segment, director Simon Winsor and screenwriter executive producer Bill Whitliff discuss their collaboration with the show's composer, the late Basil Polidorus.
He's no longer with us, but he was suggested to us by another director, a friend of Dyson's called Randall Kleiser, and he'd just worked with Basil. And I forget the name of the film, but we heard the score and it was magic. And as Bill and Suzanne have said earlier, when Basil started coming out with the themes, we were all just so moved. They were so right. And he would wrestle with the theme, you know, for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then literally write the score in a matter of no time at all. And we were halfway through the sound mix of the film, and we literally had one more day's mixing. Basil was going to record in the morning, and we were going to drop it into the score, to the soundtrack in the afternoon. And he said, oh, look, I've only got 11 more minutes to write when I get home. And this was at 10 o'clock at night. So what he'd do, he'd go home, sketch out the score for that particular scene, and then he'd fax it across to his arrangers. And, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, there they were playing it on stage. He was an incredible character, a delightful man, and I think every piece of music is totally appropriate.
Basil Poledouris was the guy who wrote the score for A Lonesome Dove. He would play the music for Suzanne and Dyson, and he would call me long distance. I was in Austin, and he had some kind of contraption that he could put his phone on, and then he would play music, and then he would say, Bill, that's for such and such. And one night he played the theme, and tears just rolled down my cheeks. And I said, my God, Basil, I said, where did you get that? And he said, oh, melodies. He said, the air is just full of melodies. He said, if you want a melody, he said, you just reach up and grab one like that. And then several years later, Willie and I were driving down to South Padre. Well, I can't tell that story. We got to South Padre. And Willie started playing music for this film we were doing. And it was music that had never been heard on earth before. And Willie would watch me, and if I looked like I was interested in it, he would build it. But if I didn't look interested, he'd drop it and pick up something else. And finally, around 4 o'clock in the morning, I said, my God, Willie. I said, where are you getting all that? And he said, oh, melodies. He said, the air is just full of melodies. He said, if you want a melody, you just reach up and grab one.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We close this very special episode of On Story with Lonesome Dove co-star Robert Duvall offering a final reflection on this iconic Western.
We came together 27 years ago. I've gotten to travel a lot. Wherever you go, people know about Lonesome Dove, whether it's Europe, Ireland. I heard of a gaucho in Argentina that wore out a copy of a DVD watching it. A woman came up to me, because people all over Texas especially, like Danny said, it's like an iconic thing in Texas. People gather once a year, at least families, to sit and watch this, you know. And a woman came up to me and said, Mr. Duvall, I loved it so much. My family would watch Lonesome Dove every year. At least once a year, he said. In fact, I would not allow my daughter's fiancé to marry into the family until he had seen Lonesome Dove.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.